This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. The most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Hello and welcome to the Movie Squad podcast, the official podcast of RTRFM and Movie Squad, starring me, Tristan Fidler.
And me, Simon Morato.
Yes, and with this podcast is an extension of what we do every week, which is Friday at 7:30 a.m. on Breakfast with Taylor on RTRFM 92.1. And this is a chance to, you know, hear more of our thoughts and ideas about movies, and also to hear our reviews occasionally as well.
Yeah, this is what the people have been crying out for. More thoughts from you and I. But look, I think we have a bit more fun. Not that we don't have a lot of fun on the radio, but in the podcast, I guess we can dig a little bit deeper and we can get a little bit weirder.
Yes.
And we can just go for longer, which is just a benefit for everyone, I think.
Yes, so thank you for listening. Please subscribe, rate and review our podcast. And if there's someone that you know who loves movies but hasn't heard of either me or Simon or RTRFM, please share it with them and spread the word.
Arthur, does it help to have someone to talk to?
My mother always tells me to smile and put on a happy face. She told me I had a purpose, to bring laughter and joy to the world.
Stop them!
Is it just me? Or is it getting crazier out there?
Smile, though your heart is aching, smile.
Like, I don't know, do you call this an anti-superhero? Or an anti-hero?
Supervillain movie.
Yeah, there you go. It's a supervillain origin story. We're, of course, talking about Joker, one of the most hotly anticipated films of the year, and one that has become probably the biggest mainstream lightning rod of mainstream movies in 2019. It comes from director Todd Phillips, who is best known for, and I love Janice's expression right now as I lay into his filmography, The Hangover 1, The Hangover 2, The Hangover 3, Old School, Road Trip, I think, from in the day. Not the person you would expect to produce a Martin Scorsese-inspired, dark, gritty film about mental illness and radicalization, which is what Joker is. It's sort of diverging from the comic book lore of Joker, who is best known as the arch nemesis of Batman, and it provides a new origin story for him. And don't expect to see Batman in this movie. Bruce Wayne is just a little boy who we get to spy a few times. But really it focuses on Arthur Fleck, who is played by Joaquin Phoenix, a mentally ill man who has this condition where he, due to some trauma in his past, his body sort of involuntarily bursts into pained laughter. He chokes out these laughs at the most inopportune and awkward moments. He also has a non-stop stream of negative thoughts, as he tells his social worker. And yet, he has an ultimate dream of becoming a stand-up comic because he wants to wind up on the late-night talk show of Murray Franklin, who's played by Robert De Niro in a pretty clear nod to Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy, the Martin Scorsese films that Joker quite genuinely is a remix of. It is those two movies sort of smushed together with a DC Comics villain at its core. But Arthur Fleck, he's having a hard time. He works as a party clown in the day, but that results in just constant humiliations. And ultimately, when social services are cut off to him and his madness starts to spiral, he begins to take it out in violent means, and ultimately that starts to quiet his demons, or at the very least makes him feel like his demons are being quieted, and we start to see the beginnings of his march towards super villainy. Mm-hmm. Now, Janice, you've been your head's been very active during that description in terms of reacting viscerally. Now, you haven't seen Joker yet,
no,
have you?
I have. I've
oh, you
seen
did
it.
See it.
I did
oh,
see
fantastic.
It. I saw
okay.
it yesterday.
I wasn't sure if you had seen it or not. Mm-hmm. So tell me how you kind of felt about this movie, which has, we should say, been very controversial because it does seem to many that it is justifying the actions of someone that would become a shooter or an incel, you know, an involuntary celibate, a domestic terrorist. He's kind of being, you know, this Arthur Fleck character is being viewed as potential inspiration or someone to admire.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I went into this and I really wanted to rise above all that when I saw it and let the film kind of do its thing. And you know what? I liked it. I think the thing about these sorts of films is that, you know, the discussion around it is so intense, you know, and it, plus it won at Venice, and so there's all this expectation around it. Look, I found it a compelling film. I think that you're right, some people are going to put this on a pedestal. I think that the film tries very hard. In fact, it is very careful to suggest that the origins of this person's violence is society and the inequality between rich and poor. I think that in order to kind of take it as an incel kind of hero, you'd have to make a very deliberate misreading of the film. And I think people will do that. Yes, they will. However, I don't think that's on the film. And I think that the film is interesting because, you know, I see this a bit more in Hollywood films. They're trying to be a bit more, I guess, socially aware, a bit more woke. Sorry, I hate that word, but I'm just going to use it anyway. And this film very much makes clear that this is a society where the rich are getting richer and there is less and less available for people falling through the cracks. And that is absolutely how it's set up. So, yeah, look, I mean, I definitely appreciated that that was what it was trying to do. I mean, what did you think about it?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And Taylor, I know you're looking forward to this movie or but you don't quite know what you're in for, really. And what I was most surprised by, and it's been impossible to avoid the conversation around this movie, what I was surprised that it is quite even-handed. You know, it doesn't excuse his behaviour, but it does also provide potential explanations that ultimately can be used to explain how so many Americans can turn to such violent ends as well. So I found that really, I appreciated that, and I liked the film. I think Joaquin Phoenix is really amazing in this really very physical, sinewy performance. But there is the element where it's like, well, why wouldn't I just watch Taxi Driver again? Because it really is reheated Taxi Driver from beginning to end with bits of King of Comedy thrown in, and they're just such better films. And so it's very hard to have this movie that is such a explicit homage but doesn't rise above those other movies. And the same with films like Christine by Antonio Campos and Elephant by Gus Van Sant. These are very similar analogues. And I can't believe we're using these movies as comparisons for something like Joker, which should be fun for the whole family, you know. It should be the supervillain film. But I think it falls into the one-and-done category where I have no desire to watch this again because it's really unpleasant. It's a really hard watch, and I left with a splitting headache just from the violence and chaos of it all.
Yeah, and I have to say it is quite violent. And, you know, there are some amazingly shot moments that really are viscerally engaging and quite shocking, I have to say. Mm. And I say that as a compliment to the film because it's meant to be it's meant to be shocking, but, you know, whoa, this film is quite intense. You're right. Yeah.
How does that work for you?
Yeah, well, look, the reason that this was on my radar before sort of any of the commentary around it in the world was a couple of months ago I was at the cinema and I saw this preview for a film, as you do, and it took me maybe 2/3 of the way through to actually realize what film this was, and it was the Joker preview, which I think that's what really intrigued me about it. Your review, again, has sort of intrigued me even more to want to see, like, how it actually plays out. But I do understand that there is, like, that huge critique on society, especially in the US, and where people are kind of left by the wayside.
Yeah, and I just want to add a little caveat to that, which is it certainly brings that into the mix, and that's good, and I approve. It's a But, you know, it is a popcorn movie. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't propose any solutions. I mean, certainly there are moments like there's a moment where there's three Wall Street types on the subway and, you know, that ends in some violence. And one of them looks a lot like Donald Jr., I have
he
to
does.
Say. So, I mean, it's definitely in there, but don't expect any kind of real radical commentary here. It's kind of used, this sort of situation, the divisions between the rich and poor is used to kind of salt the soup, I guess. But it is good to see it in there at least. But this is a popcorn movie as well.
Like, it raises interesting questions that are worthy of discussion. The film itself isn't so fascinating,
right.
But it has that great central performance. It looks beautiful, and it has those moments that'll kind of shake and stir you if that's what you're looking for. But this ain't The Dark Knight. This ain't Batman, you know, the Adam West version or the Michael Keaton version. This is a whole new thing. And it's really only a Joker film in name only. Like, if this was called, you know, Comedian, you would not blink an eye and you probably wouldn't even draw comparisons to the DC lore, except for the references to the Wayne family. This is ultimately a tale of mental illness and radicalization. And yeah, it'll be an interesting one to see how audiences react to it, whether they flock or whether they stay away.
It's quiet here tonight.
Yeah, I finally get you all to myself.
Oh, come on, man. Huh? Someone get the bottle out of that guy's hand.
It's probably one of the kids.
Who were you talking to last night?
There was these college kids. They left a cell phone there. And I went through it to see whose it was. You don't want to see it. You don't want to see it. It's awful.
That's right. So if you don't want to go out and see a movie in the cinema, you can always stay home and watch Netflix, which is what I did last Friday night. This film just released last week called Wounds, and it's a very interesting film. It stars Armie Hammer, who, as an actor, there's something funny I always find a little bit about him. I think because he's such a milquetoast wasp embodiment of white privilege, and whenever I see him on a talk show, it's just always funny, the kind of the material he brings for anecdotes, which just seem very just like someone coming down from the ivory tower having to deal with, like, oh my God, I had to eat street vendor food. I couldn't believe it, Conan. You know, anyway, but so something. But he, you know, he is can be good in terms of the way that he's used. He was in Call Me By Your Name, which kind of gave him a lot of indie cred. And he is the star of this film, which shows him up as a kind of bartender in New Orleans. He's kind of just sort of a bit of a cad, and he's someone who has potential and promise, but seems to be kind of just like being very lazy in his life. He sort of enjoys kind of staying up all night, serving drinks at this bar, or waking up and starting to drink. And then he has this kind of weird relationship dynamic where he doesn't really, he's a little bit jealous of his girlfriend who is studying at university, and is jealous of the relationship that she has with a college professor, even as he flirts shamelessly with a friend that he has a history with, played by Azazaz Beetz. And Dakota Johnson plays his girlfriend. So he seems like a bit of a jerk. But, they, you know, that's always a great main character to have in a horror film in terms of the horrors that might await a jerk like that. And basically it all starts with a phone that's found one night during an altercation. He takes it home in terms of, rather than putting it in lost and found, he sort of just takes it absentmindedly. And then the phone starts to kind of reveal images, videos that are quite disturbing and linked to some weird arcane ritual curse, which starts to make his life a living hell. And, you know, certain things develop in terms of body wounds, hence the title, disturbing images coming through his phone or his girlfriend's laptop, ghosts in his room, and it builds up from there. Anyway, this is from director Babak Anvari, who made an Iranian horror film called Under the Shadow, which is on Netflix also, and I only saw recently. Simon, you're a fan of this film.
Yeah, that film is really good.
And it's similar in that to that film in that it starts off more as a character study and a drama first, then a horror film, and the horror kind of you know, gradually builds up and ebbs in. But it's, I think, a little bit more disturbing than Under the Shadow, and it kind of, you know, it's based on a novella, I believe, but it's also kind of feels like it's taking in a little bit of J-horror influences, a lot of kind of techno kind of fear, and just bizarre imagery. And overall, I really thought this film was great. I mean, it's very goofy. There's some moments that are kind of funny, and I think intentionally funny, but sometimes it doesn't seem that way due to the fact of Armie Hammer kind of looking at his phone and going, oh my God. But like, it's better than you think, I think, because there's really some disturbing imagery, and the way that it kind of all builds and wraps up, I was very satisfied with, even though it's kind of sending the message boards into a bit of a tailspin with like people trying to decode what it all means. Now, Simon, you've also seen Wounds. What did you make of this, and did you enjoy it?
Tristan, this is where we diverge, because I thought this was not very good at all.
You didn't think it was good?
No, I didn't.
Interesting. Yeah.
Taylor, have you even heard of this movie?
I've literally Netflix, never heard of it.
Exactly. Netflix just drops these movies and is like, look, here's three major stars in a piece of tosh. But I was really sucked in to begin with and really excited because I loved Under the Shadow. And it definitely has a feel of it that recalls Videodrome, David Cronenberg, and towards the end especially, the Denis Villeneuve film Enemy, which is similarly confounding sort of mystery horror. But I really just didn't think it congealed. And it builds to this really absurd ending, which is really fascinating, but I don't think it pays off in the way that it thinks it does. And I'm really dancing around a lot of spoilers here. But generally, I just thought throughout the film, it just started to lose the thread, and everything that was quote-unquote scary about it, like the cursed phone, becomes very silly. And I do like Armie Hammer's performance here. He is playing like a real a-hole. he's meant to be quite unlikable and a jerk, and I think that's interesting. But it's very hard to get on board with his journey because he's so self-destructive, and I know that's the metaphor of the film. But it just did not pay off for me, and I was laughing more than I was hiding behind my pillow.
Interesting. I mean, it is, I think, going to be very divisive in that I think for horror fans, this might mystify them in that it's not complete horror all the way. It's not like a Friday the 13th sequel where, you know, there's something disturbing happening every 10 minutes. It kind of takes its time, really. And for those who might want something a bit more, you know, established. Yeah, there are moments where it is quite silly, but I kind of enjoyed that and just took it in. And it for me personally, it kind of helped balance the things that were quite just full on about it in a matter of speaking. So, I mean, that's interesting to hear. But look, it's definitely a divisive film, and your reaction may either be mine or Simon. But, you know, Simon's got better taste, so I think I might be in the minority. But yeah, it's on Netflix. I think it's worth watching, if only just kind of like figure out where you stand on it.
To let us know, I'd be keen. Are you team Tristan or team Simon on Wounds?
Jacob Edward thing. It's no, I don't do that.
I mean, what you were saying before about watching Ready or Not and kind of being, you know, realizing that you are not down for gore. I guess this film's out for you in terms of watching it.
Look.
I mean, how do you feel about Armie Hammer in general?
I don't know. I've decided that I have a very specific quota of like horror, gore, thriller, anything like that. I have a very specific quota intake per year.
Sure.
And I feel like I've maybe already reached it.
Well, definitely, if you had to pick one and you had to leave the house, Ready or Not, the film we talked about beforehand, is definitely more of a crowd pleaser and something that is satisfying. Whereas, you know, I can completely understand both Simon's position and those who might have watched Wounds and just scratched their head and gone, what the hell is this? But look, I think just check it out. If you're bored looking around on Netflix and you don't know what this is, just have a watch and see.
I will say it's like 90 minutes, right?
Yeah,
like,
and that's, that's the other thing. It is 90 minutes mercifully, so I think that's a good strength to have as well.
I just want to take care of my grandma, maybe go shopping every once in a while.
When I was a kid, I always wanted to work with animals. I was close.
These Wall Street guys. You see what they did to this country? They stole from everybody. Hardworking people lost everything. And not one of these douchebags went to jail.
The game is rigged, and it does not reward people who play by the rules.
It's like robbing a bank, except you get the keys.
Are you in? I got a
Hustlers, the film by Loreen Scafaria. So you probably have seen the advertisements for this everywhere. Jennifer Lopez and Constance Wu, their faces everywhere with like neon kind of titles underneath, Hustlers. So in essence, this film is based on a true story, actually, a New York Magazine article about a group of exotic dancers who, in the wake of the global financial crisis, got up to some really creative means of making a few dollars. Well, actually, more than a few dollars, but I get ahead of myself. So this story is told in flashback. It starts with Destiny, played by Constance Wu. The year is 2007, and she's just started a new job as an exotic dancer in a big downtown strip club in New York City. And she starts off, she doesn't really know the ropes, she's not very good at dancing or giving lap dances. And so she meets and teams up with Ramona, played by Jennifer Lopez, in amazing form, just so charismatic, burning a hole in this film, who teaches her basically how to dance and how to work the clientele in the club, the big Wall Street types. And things are going really well, a really strong bond between these two dancers forms. However, everything falls, you know, the floor falls out from beneath them when the global financial crisis hits, and their Wall Street clientele just don't have the money or the inclination to come to the club and spend big on dancers, right? So a few years pass, you know, the two women get a couple of jobs in retail, but they kind of suck, their managers are jerks, they don't give them flexible work hours because they're both single mums. And so they go back to, you know, back to the old life that they knew in the kind of adult entertainment industry. However, they're a bit more creative this time because all the bankers, they're a bit more, let's say, tight with their purse strings. And so they start teaming up with other women to actually drug the Wall Street types that they pick up in the bars around New York City. We're just a little bit that they describe it as a sprinkle of substances. just to loosen them up a little bit and make them a bit freer with their credit cards. And basically scamming them for literally tens of thousands of dollars per night. And of course, things can't necessarily go this way the whole time. Greed becomes a factor in the story, and things go a little bit pear-shaped from there. So this is a really entertaining film. I'm sure you can gather that it's kind of like this fun heist film about, you know, women kind of trying to get theirs in the wake of this massive global financial catastrophe. And in a way, they really do blame these Wall Street clients that they have for the situation that they're in. And this is just really a tremendously entertaining film. It's got amazing performances from Constance Wu and, of course, Jennifer Lopez, I think. You know, a lot of people have kind of forgotten that she began her career as an actress and a really talented actress. And she is so tremendously charismatic in this film. She burns a hole in this film. She's amazing at pole dancing. There's like a famous scene right at the beginning of the film where she does like a dance to Criminal by Fiona Apple. And it's just this spectacular introduction. Her hair is like the mane of a mythical creature. She's just so charismatic in this film. And look, it's just a really fun, entertaining kind of spectacle heist movie. Yeah. And I know, Tristan, you got a chance to see this film. What was your impressions of it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. I'd heard the hype about it, that it debuted at, I think, the Toronto Film Festival and got a lot of great critical buzz around it. And when Martin Scorsese made Goodfellas, he set kind of like a benchmark for a kind of subgenre of movies of kind of based on true crime stories, this kind of like a very, you know, using music, going kind of fast, the sort of rise and fall of the kind of criminal endeavor. And there's been so many kind of like imitators and films that and TV shows that have followed in its wake, but they're pretty much all male dominated, and the female characters are usually kind of supplementary at best. And so to see that kind of style with, you know, pretty much the primary figures are, you know, all female characters is great, is kind of an overdue sort of balancing of the books. And then the fact that to compare it to like films from the 90s that about exotic dancing, like Showgirls or Striptease, you know, were made by male directors, and they still come at things from a male kind of gaze and a very sexualized, whereas The dancing in this, it kind of like really looks at the style and the skill, and it's really kind of, it really makes a difference as well. And the soundtrack, yeah, I mean, is phenomenal. There's some great, you know, mid-2000s drops like Gimme More by Britney Spears.
Yes.
Even a Scott Walker track is in there. And they're
okay.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun watching this as well. So, yeah, I mean... Like, I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to add, Janice, about
the
film.
No, I mean, I was watching it, and you're right, because the filmmakers have a challenge, because these are, you know, they are exotic dancers. So how do you make this film without it being voyeuristic in a way that's not, you know, not what we want? But at the same time, of course, they are meant to be sexy creatures of the night, and we do, like, that has to be part of the story as well. I do think that perhaps it could have had a tiny bit more of that. I mean, there was a lot of sort of editing that kind of, you know. But I appreciate that this film is trying to reach a broader audience, and it doesn't really want to be about kind of the sordid elements. Like, for instance, if you do read the original 2015 New York Magazine story upon which this is based, you'll know that there are a few more kind of sordid details to the true story of these events. And they're not in the film. But you can see that the reason for that is that it's trying to actually make it more about the crime element. And it's really focused on female friendships as well. And you mentioned Showgirls, and you're quite right in that. When you know, Destiny first arrives at the club in 2007, I'm just waiting for the bitchiness to happen and for there to be competition. But the film completely subverts that expectation, because, you know, there's an amazing scene where she approaches Ramona, so Jennifer Lopez's character, and, you know, who's obviously the queen of the club. But instead of, you know, telling, you know, asserting power over her, she's like, yeah, come over here, climb into my jacket, it's really cold. Like, she's wearing this massive fur coat, and, you know, Destiny climbs in and they have a little cuddle, and they've only just met. And it's this really sort of wanting to create this kinship and this friendship between the women, which I really appreciated and is a real pleasure of this movie. Yeah, Taylor, are you at all interested in this one?
I am really interested in this. The cast is what initially drew me in, and I'm not one that usually falls victim to, like, movies who do the whole, like, pre-promotion thing, but I did notice with Hustlers, it was popping up sort of all over all of my feeds of, like, the training,
yes,
sort of behind-the-scenes elements of, like, Jennifer Lopez learning how to pole dance and constant we were learning how to do that, and I really enjoyed seeing that, and that's just definitely what pushed me over the line to definitely go and see
this.
Yeah,
and you definitely fall within the demographic, so yeah. I'm sure it's like targeted advertising, let's go. Yeah, me too. And look, and full credit to the cast, I think they're all really strong. I do think that it's Jennifer Lopez's film in many ways, even though she's not actually the main character. She puts in an amazing, like, she has such charisma. She's such a joy to watch. And, yeah, she does indeed do all of her own dancing. And, you know, it's fabulous and a really entertaining thing to see. Yeah, and I also have to point out, I do love the fact that it starts in 2007. It's like a period film, and all the terrible fashions
right,
and the luxury.
The fact that we can even say 2007 is a period film now, like, that's a little bit scary.
It's a bit scary, but you know what? I'm embracing it. I'm accepting it. Yeah.
Tell me something. Why is it so hard for you to kill this man?
He knew every move of mine before I made it. I'd have him right there and take the shot.
I wanna be forever young.
And he'd be gone, like a ghost.
Do you really wanna live forever?
Who is he?
Gemini Man. And it's interesting, we go from Jennifer Lopez to Will Smith, and I wouldn't say their careers are, you know, the same, but they're both kind of identified with the 90s and are both kind of these personalities that have done the crossover between acting and being kind of pop stars, or in his case, a rap superstar. And, you know, they're both at a kind of different stage in their career. Though, yeah, Will Smith, I don't know. How do you both feel about him as an actor and a presence on screen?
Well, look, I wasn't really old enough when The Fresh Prince came out to enjoy it then, so I found that later as, like, a young adult, and I liked it. And, you know, he did Hitch and he did other things and, like, it's cool.
Yeah, I like Will Smith. I think he's very, you know, he's family friendly.
Yes.
And I think that works on occasion, but not always. Sometimes,
are we like aggressively neutral towards Will Smith?
Well, I feel like he invites aggressive neutrality in his persona. I think that's the point I'm trying to get across.
Yeah, there is something where he has kind of taken on a mantle of being very sort of... I mean, it's interesting, in recent years, he's more kind of energetic on social media and doing lots of kind of, almost having a film crew following him and doing these kind of, like, challenges and these, like, weird bits and pieces that he's doing.
And let's not forget, he starred in YouTube Rewind 2018, like, of the most important things that he has done, yeah.
But so, yeah, he still makes movies, and some of them have been popular and some of them are not. I mean, recently he was the genie in Aladdin, and even though, as my girlfriend described, he was very corny, I mean, he was still, you know, he's still broad, and he's still kind of entertaining, and I think he's a solid presence. But it is interesting, he is, you know, he's turned 50, he's a little bit more mellow these days, and he has this action film, Gemini Man. The other thing about this is it's directed by Ang Lee, who, as an auteur, is very interesting in that he's made some really great moving dramas. I mean, this is a person who directed Brokeback Mountain, The Ice Storm, Life of Pi, even, and then has, like, this other kind of, you know, alternates with sort of action cinema, and some that have been more successful than others. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was great. I enjoyed the first Hulk. Some people did not, but I liked what he did there. But he is, along with, like, Peter Jackson and some other filmmakers, really interested in kind of pushing the visual dimension. And so this film is shot in, I have to write this down, it's shot in a different format. It's filming at an extra high rate in and modified for 3D. What does that mean? Well, it means that there's more detail in the kind of close-ups on the actor's face and in the background. And there's kind of some advances here with CGI, because this film hinges on the basic idea that Will Smith plays a retired assassin who is confronted by a clone of himself at a young age. So it's Will Smith versus Will Smith, as the posters have touted. Though it is a bit strange, because Will Smith has really kept himself in shape, so the contrast between them is not so great. It would be, I think, more impressive if it was an actor who'd kind of fallen out of shape and had to confront his younger self. Imagine, like, an old Pacino having to wrestle with a young Pacino. I think that'd be more interesting. But the basic idea is that he's fighting with this clone of himself. And, you know, there's some great actors involved here, but they're all kind of given very substandard roles. Clive Owen is the bad guy. There's, like, lots of, like, CIA stuff. It's all kind of very Jason Bourne-esque. Mary Elizabeth Winstead is in there, Benedict Wong. But the film overall is very kind of muted, and I felt a bit nostalgic for some of the mid-2000s Will Smith movies, like I, Robot, where just, like, more is, like, he's wisecracking more and there's more being thrown at you. This is very kind of, it's a very strange experience, or very, well, I should say, underwhelming experience. This film, really, I felt kind of not interested by. And I thought that with the idea, they didn't really explore it creatively. It seemed like they could have just cast a younger actor and it would have just been the same movie. So this film to me was a disappointment, particularly, you know, Will Smith has had a shaky track record with some of his previous films, like Collateral Beauty and Collision, I think. And Ang Lee as well, who his previous film was Billy Lynn's Halftime Walk, which was not a success, but at least was trying something a bit more interesting and dramatic. Here, it's a very kind of mundane movie. Janice, I mean, I don't know if you, after this review, I'm not sure if you're going to go see it, but, like, what do you think of this and Ang Lee and Will Smith? I mean, is there any take or reading that you have about
Ang Lee,
this?
Ang Lee, you know, I mean, you do sometimes ask yourself why. But I wanted to ask you, I'm sure you can't reveal too much of the plot, but why is there a clone? Can you reveal why there might be an assassination attempt? Is there, like, it just, like, why? Why is this happening
in the story? The logic that is given is that Will Smith, as an assassin, is the best. He at the opening sequence, he shoots a target from a moving train. Oh, he's not moving, but the train is moving. But and he's retiring. He says in a very expository line of dialogue, "My soul is dead. I've got to move on. I can't look at myself in the mirror anymore." And so the CIA, his this guy Clive Owen, who plays this guy Clay, he has taken some part of his DNA early on in their training and created this son, this new son that he kind of like isolates and forms a bond with. So yeah, it is kind of like. Like, I mean, I know that we're living in the John Wick world where, like, if you sent 100 people to kill a great assassin, it would not work. But you think, why not do that instead of, like, all these millions of dollars to create a clone that's still, anyway.
It sounds very serious and not very fun, which, you know, that's kind of what I was going for. It's like, is there a dog that has been murdered that has to be avenged, as in John Wick? No, it sounds like it's going for something more dramatic.
Yeah, that's it. It is more serious. I mean, there are kind of a couple of attempts at jokes here and there, like Mary Elizabeth Winstead and Benedict Wong are kind of like his sidekicks throughout the film. But it really, it's really just not to the level of the Will Smith that we're kind of used to, even like early 90s action film. I'm a great fan of Enemy of the State. I think that's a great one. But this is very, in comparison, it's very kind of like, I don't know why though. I don't think they expect to win an Oscar with this, but I don't know. Maybe because Ang Lee's involved, that maybe that heightened everything. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, well, the script, this idea has been kicking around since the 90s and has gone through lots of different iterations and different stars, different directors. So it does have a feeling of something that's been passed around too long.
Yes, and we were saying off air that, you know, this story about clones, assassins coming back in time and time travel and assassination time travel has been done. And when you said it had, you know, a 90s kind of origin, I'm like, okay, maybe that's part of the problem. You know, we've seen it before.
That's exactly right. It doesn't feel novel or new, and I wish they could have pushed it. There was even a moment of a I won't spoil it. There was a climactic reveal that had a pocket of the audience laughing. So the film does, and it was not intentional. Gemini Man, I think you can kind of not have to rush to the cinema to see it. You're probably, whenever it shows up and stand on Netflix, waste an afternoon on a rainy day with it. But otherwise, I'd say people go see Hustlers instead. That's where the real action is.
I have absolutely no desire to go and see this. Sorry.
For the diehard Will Smith fans only, because there have to be a few out there.
Yeah.
Totally.
And he is good. Like, he is good. But it's just a shame because of some of his previous performances. Like, you can feel that he's more invested in it, and I think he is trying to be serious. And, anyway, but people have the next Bad Boys to look forward to. Bad Boys for Life, the number 3. So if this does not fulfill your Will Smith needs, just wait around. Mike Lowry and the other guy will be.
And in the meantime, to tie you over, just keep up with Will Smith on social media.
Yes.
That's a whole other thing.
Sing a song. One for me.
I wish I were on yonder hill.
We don't want no trouble.
That's just the way, isn't it? You don't want trouble, but sometimes trouble wants you.
It's there I'd sit and cry my fill.
Get me to the soldiers that came by this morning.
It's too dangerous.
Up north, they kill us. You sure you want to follow him?
Let's start off with The Nightingale.
Yes, so this is, I would say, eagerly anticipated because it is the second film from actor-turned-director Jennifer Kent, who made such an impact a couple of years ago with The Babadook. Mm. Have you seen The Babadook?
Yes, I have, because I love horror movies. So so good.
Yeah, well, it's quite an achievement to have, let alone an Australian horror film that is, popular and accepted, but to birth an iconic character and one that it was also kind of made into a queer icon in a very funny, interesting way. So, I mean, that was such a great film and worked on so many levels as well. So it was very much, what is Jennifer Kent going to do next? And it's been interesting reading some of the interviews that she's done around the 19th Nightingale and some of the kind of the offers I'm sure she would have been, you know, receiving from Hollywood. But no, she's decided to stick with Australia for this film and in Tasmania, of all places, for The Nightingale, which is not technically a horror film, but very much horrific things happen in it. It is a drama, a thriller. It is a colonial Western in a way, but to put it in a neat genre box, I think would do it a disservice. This is definitely a very, you know, full-on hardcore movie, and that's one of the things that's got it a bit of notoriety and attention is that at several kind of film festivals that it premiered at, there were kind of walkouts, people shouting during the film, and you know, course correction has changed to make sure that people kind of are aware that this is a film that contains, you know, really upsetting scenes in the nature of sexual assault, of violence, of colonial violence against Indigenous people as well. So it's not, this is not for the faint of heart, and you should know going, well, you don't even have to go in. No one's forcing you to see this movie, even if the reviews are really great. So if it doesn't sound like your cup of tea, then I'm not going to change your mind. This is not this is not that type of film. But I will say what it is about. It's about an Irish convict during colonial times in Tasmania. Claire, played by Aisling Fiancee, sorry for the pronunciation there. Basically, for 3 years or so has been at a British soldier outpost, basically doing chores, being a servant, but is married and has a baby with another Irish convict. But she's also the kind of property of Captain Hawkins, played by Sam Claflin, who, a very frustrated individual being at the outskirts of what he considers, you know, a barbarous terrain. But, is very unpleasant as well in that he, you know, uses her to kind of sing for his men. And that's where the kind of the title comes from. She is a nightingale in that she has a lovely voice and sings for the soldiers, but he also, you know, uses her for other means as well, and is a creep, an abuser, a rapist. It's an awful situation. Anyway, all of this comes to a head where a terrible tragedy happens, and Claire wakes up left for dead, and basically has her mind set and everything else set on revenge and tracking down this captain who has gone off to Launceston to receive a promotion. And so it's basically off into the dark woods of Tasmania, and along for the ride, she gets the services of an Aboriginal tracker named Billy, played by Barkeli Ganambara. And they have a very frosty relationship. They don't trust each other. They kind of view each other with a lot of dismissiveness, but they, you know, she is paying him in order to, you know, get through the forest and find her prey, so it were. And so in one sense it is a revenge thriller, but I don't think it's kind of, this is not Kill Bill, all right? This is not a Quentin Tarantino film. This is shot in a very kind of boxy square format, and it's beset by the fact that it's locked in by history, by colonial savagery, by the mistreatment of the original inhabitants of this land by invaders. And so it doesn't wish it away in a fairy tale manner like Quentin Tarantino has done recently in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. This is a tough watch, but I thought it was very moving and powerful. The lead performances I thought were amazing, and the shooting, the editing, it's beautiful. In terms of the scenery and the filmmaking, but it's hard going. And there's a particular sequence that people in the preview screening that I was at were walking out, and I can understand that. There's no pressure to stay and watch this movie, but for me, I thought it was an open-eyed look at trying to represent the horror of Australia's history and creating these really memorable characters and this situation. Yeah, I was moved, and I mean, I wouldn't watch it again in a hurry, but I thought this was great. I mean, Simon, you've also seen this.
Yeah.
What was your reading on this film?
Look, I think it's really fantastic, and I find it so hard to recommend. Like, you know, that kind of sounds like a joke.
It doesn't happen often, I don't think.
No, it really doesn't. You know, it's one of those movies where I've gone, gosh, that was so good and so necessary, and I would love for people to watch it, but I'm not going to go to someone and say, hey, you got to sit through this, because it is actually an ordeal. It's meant to be an ordeal. That's not an accident. The screening I was in at the likely the same sequence, Tristan, as you, a person left the cinema in tears.
Oh my goodness.
That is the kind of visceral reaction this movie warrants. And again, that is intentional. When, you know, that person didn't do anything wrong by leaving the cinema. If they can't bear to see what happens next, that's understandable.
Yeah.
But I think we need to kind of wrestle with these topics and what is being sort of told in this story by Jennifer Kent. She also wrote the screenplay. That, I know it sounds like a bit of a backhanded compliment, or like it sounds like I'm telling people to stay away from it. I just think you need to know that this is a tough one. Because if you go in thinking, well, I don't really have a strong stomach for this kind of stuff, but it sounds good, you're probably not going to stick around. And I get that. But if you do have the wherewithal to kind of go, no, I want to see what this story has to offer, and I want to kind of reckon with Australian history, and we'll talk about that in our next film as well, I do think that's important. And we should also say that it is a beautifully made film. It's got great performances. It really is a great achievement in filmmaking. But you just got to know going in, this is a tough one, and you're not necessarily going to walk out smiling at the end.
Not a feeling.
How do you feel when we talk about a movie like that, and knowing that you love The Babadook?
Yeah. Well, I looked at the trailer, and definitely read the reviews, and does seem pretty confronting, but super important. Like you said, just like that look into the history that a lot of us don't really learn about. It's not in our face. And neither is this, but it's important to have that happening.
Well, you know, often the type of history that's told is from the perspective of the colonizer, and it's watered down and made kind of digestible. You know, Jennifer Kent has made this with consultation of elders in the kind of the tribes represented in Tasmania, but the film has still received controversy from, you know, different areas, whether it be people who are conservative forces who like don't like the idea of this type of history being represented, and then there are other, you know, there are indigenous writers. There was one recently in the Guardian that kind of did an opinion piece in the film about the, you know, this is also like a white woman who's directing this film about these issues. So it is, you know, this is not an easy thing to deal with. But I think that, you know, to zoom out, what that is doing is looking at the fact that our history is not an easy thing to deal with and shouldn't be. So, yeah, this is, as Simon was saying, look, if you don't feel like you're up for it, it's not gonna turn your mind around. But I thought, you know, for me, from my perspective, for watching it, I thought it was very moving. The performances from I think the three main principals are great, and this is a testament to, I think, Kent's power and mastery as a filmmaker. So, you know, hopefully her next film will probably be more palatable and will have more of a general audience. But I thought The Nightingale was great.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.